Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From the Alexander Castor Theater at Montclair State University, this is a very special edition of The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. Good morning, everyone. We have, as you can hear, hundreds of people in the house who want to be here so much that they have braved flooded roads, washed out bridges, down power lines, risking electrocution, and fall term registration at Montclair State just to join us at Castor Theater today. So first of all, give yourselves a round of applause. And we hope to make the trip here worth it for you, whether you are here in the hall or have merely commuted to your radio or the internet to be with us. Let's find out, for the sake of the listening audience, who's here in the hall today. If you are a student or faculty or staff member at Montclair State, give the school a round of applause. School spirit is alive and well at Montclair. I heard the yelps. If you are anyone else who lives in Montclair, let's hear you. Interesting. Let's hear it if you live in Montclair but used to live in New York City. A lot. How about if you started on the Upper West Side, moved to Brooklyn when you had your first child, and then Montclair when you had your second? So the legend is true. I think you should have your own census category. If you're here from Maplewood, South Orange, or Millburn, let's hear it. Did you boil your water before brushing your teeth this morning? Thanks a lot, Irene, for that, right? Where else did anyone come from to get here today? Shout it out. Little Falls, Bloomfield, Westfield. Okay, who said Little Falls? What's the best and worst thing about Little Falls?
The best thing is pizza.
Somebody's pizza. I couldn't hear it as well. A certain pizza place?
Yeah.
Is that the best thing or the worst thing? What's the worst thing? Oh, being very political. How about the Bloomfield person? Best thing about Bloomfield, where are you? Want to shout it out?
Sure. Great neighborhood.
Great neighborhood. Great school. Worst thing?
Taxes.
Now I know that we are, in fact, in the New Jersey suburbs. First mention of property taxes at 10:09. Surprised it took that long. All right, that's a little tease for everyone of a later part of the program where you'll all get the chance to answer that question. If you came here from a house without power today, let's hear it. Just a few, good. So among those of you, if you came here mostly for the electricity, let's hear it. Come here mostly for the air conditioning? All right, we'll hear from you all a lot today. And let's get right to our first very special guest, former New Jersey Governor and Chairman of the 9/11 Commission, Tom Kaine. Please welcome Governor Kaine. Thanks so much. Have a seat. Governor, welcome. Thank you so much for doing this.
Great to be here.
We're really, really honored.
Welcome the others who don't have power yet.
Now, you were governor from 1982 to 1990, so you were in office for Hurricane Gloria. Do you remember it being as bad or worse than the effects of Irene?
We had some very bad flooding, and I remember having not to evacuate people. I didn't evacuate anybody, but we had to do a lot of help for the people in Wayne, Pequannock, Lincoln Park, some of those areas. Some areas of Bergen County went underwater. This is an area of the state that, unfortunately, when there's any problem, it floods, and it's very difficult for people.
What do you think of all this preemptive evacuation and shutting of mass transit? Are Governor Christie and Mayor Bloomberg more aggressive than that about that than in the past? And if so, is it a good thing?
I think they're more aggressive, but I think it's better to be more aggressive than not. You can look and say, well, I didn't have to do that. And maybe they didn't, but we didn't know that. We didn't know this storm was going to come inshore where it did and that the beaches were not going to be quite as badly hit as we expected. And we didn't know it was going to be so bad inland. So taking precautions is never a bad thing.
Audience, how many of you, by applause, thought that the evacuations and the preemptive shutdown of transit was media and politician hype? Mm-hmm. How many of you thought it was prudent precaution? Mm-hmm. Case closed.
Yeah.
Now, this program is the official kickoff of our series 10 Conversations for the 10th anniversary. So with the 10th anniversary coming in less than 2 weeks, let me ask you, Governor, to put on your 9/11 Commission Chairman hat. Are we safer from such attacks today than we were 10 years ago?
Oh, no question it was safer. I mean, we've done a lot of things to make the country safer. Are we as safe as we should be? No. There are still some things we ought to do.
Well, in May of last year, you were quoted calling it the most dangerous time since 9/11. I saw this on NJ.com. You spoke of a sense of urgency, and you said Al-Qaeda is constantly learning our weaknesses, and the U.S. intelligence community is dysfunctional. I think that's an exact quote. Did you say those things, and do you still believe both those things today?
I may have said congressional oversight is dysfunctional, rather than intelligence community, and I can explain that if you want. It's dangerous for these reasons. Times have changed. Al-Qaeda has changed. We've got to get ahead of them and not behind them. For instance, Al-Qaeda now is separated into a number of areas of the world. It isn't just coming from Pakistan or Afghanistan. It's coming from Somalia, Yemen, a number of other ungoverned parts of the world. And they're not necessarily planning just great big attacks like the 9/11 attack. It's one-off people. They're sending individuals, if they can, such as the guy, the so-called underpants bomber, or the fellow who tried to bomb in Times Square. And a third thing is they're trying to recruit American citizens. A lot of our defenses, a lot of the things we've done since 9/11, are to stop people from coming into the country. Well, if they're already in the country with an American passport, then they're much harder to defend against. So we've had a lot of examples, of, particularly over the Internet, of Al-Qaeda trying to recruit American citizens. Those are three big changes, and we've just got to get ahead of those changes and accommodate ourselves to them and make sure we're ahead, not behind this time.
The homegrown threat, Fort Hood, the attempted Times Square bombing, others. Do you think Congressman Peter King was on the right track with the hearings on that? So many Muslims felt it was discrimination more than information, and yet there is a homegrown terrorism threat.
There is a threat, and I think there are different ways to deal with it. We issued a report in the small group that I chair with Lee Hamilton a couple of weeks ago on what we thought you ought to do, and what we think you ought to do really is to work much more with the Muslim communities in this country. We don't think there ought to be just police or FBI. We think that there are all sorts of people within the federal government who really ought to be. It takes about 5 or 6 years from the time somebody starts to become radicalized till they actually strap a bomb to themselves. And during those 5 or 6 years is progression. And we've got to learn how to intervene in those 5 or 6 years. These are young people, impressionable. And we've got to find a way to intervene in those three or four years, in ways that turn them back again and make them recognize it isn't the right path.
Do you know what some of those ways are? What works if somebody is being convinced that that maybe some kind of radical thinking and even radical action might be in their interest, in the world's interest, as they see it?
Well, let me just separate what you said there. Radical thinking or radical action? Nothing wrong with radical thinking in this country. I mean, we've always had radicals in this country, and that's fine. They're free to be as radical as they want to be, but the time at which they want to take action and injure other people, that's the difference. And it's a big step from somebody who just believes radically and somebody who acts radically. And we happen to believe, in the report we came out with, what we said is, look, if we can get people into these communities, and they are generally young people in these communities, generally Muslim, and they generally are separated in many ways from the community and from other people. And we've got to find out who they are, intervene, have ways in which they can get information other than just radically in the internet, and try to change minds and hearts if possible. We happen to feel the best way to do it. It's not through law enforcement. It's not, we've got to, of course, defend ourselves and be ready, but it's much better if you can prevent these things before they start.
Let me go back to our intelligence services. In that same NJ.com article last year, you said the FBI is still not fixed, and this is the part you just referred to, the Homeland Security Department depends too much or spends too much time reporting to the 100 congressional subcommittees that have some kind of jurisdiction. Is it really 100, or were you just kind of using an expression?
I wish I was. No, it's about 100. They, believe it or not, if you can imagine this, let's say you're Janet Napolitano, and you've been given a job of running Homeland Security, in other words, protecting all of us, and all of a sudden, you find out you're reporting to 100 different committees and subcommittees of the United States Congress, and you're spending at least a third of your time preparing testimony or testifying, you and your top deputies. That's a third of your time you're not spending protecting us. This is dysfunctional. The Congress doesn't do that in any other area. Some reason they do it in this area. There should be a limit of 8 committees maybe at most in the two houses that she reports to and the department reports to. That's one of the things that makes congressional oversight dysfunctional.
And do they make it harder? I mean, if I'm a member of Congress, I want to facilitate effective Homeland Security, not tie its hands.
But you don't want to give up your committee here. I'm the committee chairman. They want to tell the constituents, look, we had the secretary before us yesterday. Or we had our top deputy before us yesterday and had my picture taken with her. See, here I am and here she is. It's very hard for them to give that up. If you're going to make this functional and go down to 8 committees, so that means 80 or so committees and subcommittees are not going to have the opportunity to call the department leaders whenever they want to. That they don't want to give up, and the leadership is not wanting to make them give it up at the moment. We hope that's going to change. Talking to the FBI, your second point, no, it's not fixed yet. The FBI, when we first encountered it as a 9/11 commission and studied the FBI, this was the FBI of J. Edgar Hoover. I mean, their job was to knock down a door, get the evidence, lead agent leading the way, bring somebody to trial, and convict them. So we, 9/11 Commission, later the Congress, went to the FBI and said, look, we want you to change, because now you're just not going to just bring people to trial. We want to prevent plots. Therefore, when you get information, you've got to use that information, share it with other government agencies, put it together, and prevent something. That's a whole different approach. And the other thing, you know, that we've got to do is recognize there are levels in the FBI. The top person has always been the agent. That's who you see in the movies. That's who's exciting, the agent, the FBI agent, leading the attack, leading the investigation. Well, we're very good at collecting information, very good. We're not very good at putting it together and using it. For those, we've got to have people who are called analysts. And the analysts now are at least as important as the agents, because they get all these millions of pieces of information that come in every single day. And they have to put them together.
That's what we heard right after 9/11, connect the dots.
Yes, that's right.
I think you called it a failure of imagination.
Yeah, and it's the analysts who do that. So the analysts have got to be just as prestigious as the agents. They've got to be paid just as much, or maybe even more. They've got to be recognized for what they do in an agency that has never recognized them. And we've got to keep them employed and hire more of them.
And in 10 years, that's not the case because?
It's much better. Because you're changing the whole culture. I mean, this is very difficult to change the culture of an old agency, and that's been the problem. It's much better. I don't indicate this is not going on. Under Director Mueller, this is something he's been pushing. It's much, much better. When I said it's not fixed yet, what I meant was we're not all the way there. We still have some of these problems.
Former Governor Tom Kaine, former 9/11 Commission Chairman, Tom Kaine with us here at Montclair State on WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. For those of you in our live audience, if you have a question for Governor Kaine, you can raise your hand. We'll start coming around with the microphones. For those of you listening on the radio, you can call in 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. While people are getting their questions ready, how do you think the state of New Jersey is different today than it was 10 years ago? And I realize that's a very general question, but do you think 9/11 has changed the state in security terms, in the relationship with working in Manhattan, for the towns that lost many people, city of Hoboken and elsewhere, however you see the effects?
You see them in all those ways. I mean, the most immediate effect, I mean, the families of 9/11 are the most extraordinary people I've ever worked with. I mean, the voices of 9/11, the other organizations of the families, so many of them have taken the greatest tragedy in their lives, and we lost almost as many people as New York. I went to funerals for 5 months probably after 9/11 in the towns around me. These people have taken the worst experience that can ever happen to an individual, and they've turned it into trying to help other people. For instance, the families of 9/11, Voices of 9/11, is now working with Rutgers University in the state of New Jersey to study the effects of that trauma on the children. And their idea is not just to help the children of the victims of 9/11, but also any kind of tragedy that happens, any event like this. What can we learn about trauma? What can we learn about trauma in children? What can we do to make sure that in the future we know how to treat it? I mean, that's going to be a tremendous contribution. Whenever I testify in Washington before Congress on the subject of trying to make this country safer and trying to implement the recommendation 9/11 Commission, I have never done it without three or four members of the family showing up to support me. They're an incredible group of people.
Audience, did any of you move to New Jersey specifically because you didn't want to live in New York City anymore after 9/11? Hands, anybody? No, I don't see it. One? Does that person want to? I can't see where that person is, but if you want to tell your story, why did you and did you get what you came for? Or we don't. Okay, I'm not seeing that person. So no, maybe it was no hands. Sorry. Okay, interesting. And of course, we see that Tribeca itself, we were talking about this on yesterday's show, is the fastest growing residential community in the city with the fastest rising property values. So people have not run away.
Oh, no, they haven't run away. And we're not the kind of people who run away from things. We rebuild and we're reborn and we turn it over and start again. That's the way Americans are.
Let's take a question from our audience right over there.
Hello. Governor, terrorists use the following dynamic. They do something evil and tragic in order to get free publicity from their victims. Denying the terrorists publicity would deal a blow to their purposes. How can a country that honors First Amendment rights prevent terrorists from getting publicity?
Well, in a free country where the news media can write whatever they want to write, and any kind of even attempted terrorist event is big news, I don't know any way you stop them from getting publicity. What you can do is stop them from being successful, hopefully. But I don't know any way in a free democracy with a free press to stop them getting publicity. And even when the government tries to prevent something from becoming public, and we find out about it, we don't like it because we think the public's entitled to everything.
You know, I'll give you an answer to that too, as the member of the media on the stage. It's much harder than it used to be, and we've come upon difficult decisions. I mean, the media collectively. I remember back in the 1980s when there were hijackings of airplanes, but they were being kept on the tarmac in one place or the other. Should the networks keep the cameras trained on the plane and have a little box on the screen that was sort of continuous coverage of the plane with the hostages aboard? Was that giving the terrorists the publicity that they wanted, enhancing their cause, or was that just informing the public and letting them see something that everybody wanted to see, a lot of people wanted to see? When the Bin Laden tapes started coming out after 9/11, we grappled with the question, do we air the Bin Laden tapes? Because their data, their information, about our enemy, or do we withhold them so he doesn't get publicity and doesn't have the opportunity to maybe get a coded message out that's supposed to trigger another attack of some kind? Mm-hmm. Usually the media is going to err on the side of free speech and decide that more information is better in the long run than less information. And now with the internet, it doesn't matter what NBC or CBS or CNN or WNYC decide to do, because they're going to get the information through networks of social media anyway. So in a way, it's becoming a moot point.
Yeah, let me turn that around a little more. I almost feel the opposite of government secrecy. When I became chairman of the 9/11 Commission, and once I got my clearance, I had the highest security clearance in the United States government. I could see everything. And I did. And I read thousands of documents that were top secret. And I'll be honest with you, I would say, conservatively, 60% of those documents never, ever should have that classification. There were things the American people were entitled to. And I just...
So are you a WikiLeaks fan?
I'm not a WikiLeaks fan, but I'm not a fan of the United States government, anything just stopping it, putting it top secret. I remember a very brief story. I remember the first time I just got my new clearance to see everything. And there had been an FBI report that I wasn't allowed to see till I got it, which was the main FBI report on 9/11, with all the things they had found out that the public didn't know yet, presumably. And so I went into the room. It was a top-secret room. An FBI agent had to look over my shoulder, and I sat there and read this 200-page report. And I finished it and looked up at the FBI agent and said, you know, there was nothing in here that I didn't know. And this is a true story. The FBI agent looked at me and said, yes, but you didn't know it was true.
Authority wins. We'll continue in a minute. From Montclair State on WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio with former governor and 9/11 Commission Chairman Tom Kaine and other guests to come, stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio from Montclair State University. We continue with our first guest, former governor, former 9/11 Commission Chair, Tom Kaine. You know, when Governor Christie was on with me the other day during hurricane special coverage, I told him about this event and you being here, and he called you a mentor. How do you mentor Chris Christie?
I thought I was going to be able to answer all your questions this morning, but I just don't know.
I didn't expect that.
I've known him since he was 14 years old, that's all I can say. We both come from Livingston.
Back in your day as governor in the 80s, were the seeds of today's fiscal crisis and crushing property taxes already being laid? Was the state borrowing too much? Were public employee pensions on the horizon as a ballooning problem, or healthcare inflation, or anything else? How do you draw the line from there to here?
Well, property taxes have been a problem in this state all my life, I think. Our property taxes have been higher than other states, much too high. We've relied too heavily on them. And what we were able to do in the 80s is bring in a lot of jobs. We brought in 750,000 new jobs in the 80s. And that enabled us to do a lot of things. One was stop the heavy rise in property tax by a lot of municipal aid. We had, during my 8 years, we had a AAA bond rating. That was the highest in the country. I think there were three other states, maybe, that had a AAA bond rating. And we were very proud of that, because that showed that we were managing things well fiscally.
So what happened? What's the big picture of what happened, as you see it, with all this, you know, arc of perspective?
We had a pay-as-you-go philosophy. I think I did, Brendan Byrne did, a number of the governors in those days. We started borrowing. We basically decided we could live on borrowed money. And then for a while after that, we stopped paying our bills. So we stopped paying pension costs and things like that. So it was a question of borrowing money, not paying. And the same thing happens if you're a homeowner. You know, if you go too far into debt, eventually it comes due, and eventually you have to pay the piper. And states, unfortunately, reach that stage now where it simply can't borrow anymore responsibly, and it can't pay its bills, and it can't not pay some of the things, some of the costs that we owe, like people's pension costs. So now we're paying the piper, and it's very, very difficult. We've got to do some very tough things now, but it's unfortunately to pay for the sins of the last 12 or 15 years.
I think we have a question in the back on this side. Hi.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Governor, for your service to our state and country. I have a question regarding the writing of the commission report itself. Dr. Philip Zelikow, it appears, had daily and consistent contact with the White House. I would question that in that he is talking to people who did not want the commission established in the first place. Would you have liked to have seen less collusion between Dr. Zelikow and the White House?
Well, let me tell you a story which I don't think I've made public up to this point. When I decided with Lee Hamilton that the best person to head the commission staff was Dr. Zelikow, I called the White House and talked to the chief of staff and said, we have decided to hire Phil Zelikow. And the chief of staff said, I hope you won't. And I said, why not? And they said, we'd rather not have him. He's a historian. We'll tell you the facts, but we don't want to tell you where we get them. An historian's footnote. And we'd rather not have him. So they didn't like his appointment to begin with. Secondly, the first time he went over to White House to negotiate for us, the president's counsel, a man named Gonzalez at that point, called me up on the phone and said, don't ever send that man here again. Because they'd had a huge fight over what was classified and what wasn't classified. And so from then on, we had to send our counsel over because he wouldn't talk to Phil Zelikow. So he wasn't the White House's favorite person. He was in contact from time to time, I believe generally in line with his job. He had to call the White House from time to time because we directed him to, because on matters. We were continually trying to get information. We continued to try to interview people who they didn't want us to interview. We were trying to get papers that they didn't want to show us. We were trying to get a lot of things. In his job, he was required to, but I don't think, we had five Republicans and five Democrats on the commission, and I don't think any of the 10 of us would tell you today that Phil Zelikow didn't do a good job.
I read one time, and tell me if I recall this accurately, that the commission considered referring to the Justice Department for criminal investigation, purposely misleading information that the Pentagon or maybe NORAD gave you about the actual military response on the day of 9/11. Is that true?
Yeah, they lied to us. They
about
no
what?
Other way to, well, the FAA and its response. And we had to hold a second hearing in which they, with great embarrassment, had to correct what they told us in the first hearing. And we found that due to, it had been actually a very good book written by a fellow called John Farmer, who is now president of the law school at Rutgers.
Former Attorney General of New Jersey,
right? Attorney General
of
the state. I hired him as one of the people to work on this investigation. And John's written a book, and if you want to find a really good book on this very subject, about how they lied to us, how we discovered the lies, and how we brought them to face the public.
He wrote that book.
John wrote
that
book.
In short form, what were they trying to hide?
The whole timetable of the day, what the response times were, when people took off, the whole timeline was wrong, and they gave us the wrong timeline, and our staff figured it out.
Because they thought they messed up?
We never really found, because they didn't look good under their own testimony, and so we never really figured out why the original lies were told, but thank goodness we found the lies out, corrected them, and the timeline, everything else is correct in 9/11 report.
There are people outside handing out leaflets of questions that they wanted people here to ask. And these folks call our show, too. And I'm just going to ask their basic question. Are you aware of what they call the report of the Citizens Commission of 9/11 and the 9/11 Truth Proclamation? And they assert that explosives, not fires, caused the collapse of the Twin Towers and the World Trade Center. They say all three towers fell down in approximately free fall time. This can only be accounted for by a controlled demolition, and they list a few other points of evidence. Any truth to that whatsoever?
I don't believe it, but I know there are people out there who sincerely believe it. I hear from them all the time. They have different theories. Some of them believe somehow the intelligence agencies were involved in the 9/11 attack. Others think the Bush administration politically had something to do with it. Others tell me the Jewish community all left the building and they had something to do with it. I mean, all these theories are out there. I don't buy them, frankly. I understand the sincerity of the people who hold them, and there are different theories about every important event in the United States history, starting with the assassination of Abraham Lincoln and going right through Pearl Harbor and Kennedy assassination, all of that. I say this sincere people have no problem, except that I don't agree with them.
I think we have a call from Rita, one of our listeners. Rita, are you there?
Yes, hi.
Do we have Rita?
Yes, can you hear me? Hello?
Go ahead, Rita. Yeah, we got you. You're on with Governor Payne. Rita, can you hear me? You're on the air.
Yes, I am. Thank you very much.
Go ahead. Turn off your radio so you don't have...
I don't have the radio on.
Okay, go ahead. It's a long way from Varick Street to Montclair. What can I say?
Okay.
I thought the speed of sound was
a
little faster than that.
What's the best way for college students or other young professionals to prepare to be an analyst that you so clearly described as so essential to protecting the country?
I think it's a wonderful career. Well, you can prepare in a number of ways. These are people who have to analyze sometimes very complicated data. Sometimes they're analyzing things in other languages. One of the things they could do is study some of those other languages that that you have to be familiar with. Other than that, it's a knowledge of language itself, an analytical basis, which sometimes you get from math and science. As a former college president, I'll tell you, I think a good liberal education can prepare you pretty well for that kind of a job.
That was an applause line. So let me finish up with you and kind of segue to our next conversation, which is going to be about teaching 9/11 in the classroom. One of your big interests has always been education. You were chair of the National Governors Association Task Force on Teaching when you were in office. You were on the President's Education Policy Advisory Committee. Was that President Reagan or Bush?
Bush. Old Bush.
And you were president of... A little defensiveness in that. president of Drew University for 15 years. And we seem to me to be caught between two poles when it comes to education right now, between a determination to leave no child behind, as they say, and really bring up the bottom in this country on the one hand, and to be outraged that somehow teachers have it too easy on the other. The union position is that Wall Street crashed the economy and we're taking it out on teachers. Can we succeed with education in the 21st century if teacher pay and benefits are going down?
In the first place, and I'm prejudiced here because I'm a teacher. I mean, before I was a governor, I was a teacher. Before I was anything, I was a teacher. That was my profession. So let me say to begin with that I think in any society that doesn't value its teachers is not going to be very successful in the long run. Having said that, it doesn't mean we can't change the way we educate. It doesn't mean we shouldn't continue to learn. We shouldn't use research. We shouldn't help teachers to do a better job. There's no reason we shouldn't have better trained principals. No reason we couldn't have better teacher education. All these things are important. But at the bottom end of it, I've always believed that what happens with all the other actors who are involved, what happens really to a student is between the teacher and the student. And if that chemistry works, everything else is going to work as well. So that's what we ought to be after.
So if we assume that it should be easier to fire bad teachers, don't let bad teachers keep teaching, if we assume that's, you know, that needs to be made easier, it's still only half the battle, right? Because how are we going to attract more good teachers from other lines of work that they might go into?
We're not only going to attract them, we got to keep them. There's probably a larger dropout rate in the teaching profession than almost any other profession I know. A lot of good young people go into it and then become discouraged one way or the other. So, one, it's attracting people into the profession, preparing them well, Secondly, it's once they're in the profession, making them valued, bringing them into the school, making them feel how important they are. I mean, there's nothing I've enjoyed more in my life than my teaching.
How much of that is money, making them feel valued?
I think the teachers obviously want to be able to make a living, but that's not the reason people go into teaching. I mean, nobody goes into teaching to become rich. That's not, they'd go in for some other reason, right? They go in to help people because they love children, they love kids, and they want to help them to advance. And there's nothing you feel better about. I'll tell you, as a teacher, nothing in my life makes me feel better than one of my former students who calls up and says, you did something that made a difference. I mean, that's the reward they get.
How many of you in the room here are either teachers or retired teachers or former teachers? How much do you think higher pay is the key to better teacher retention and recruitment? Not that strong. Part of it. It's part of it. So I think the governor's answer stands for many of you. And with that, we thank former governor, former 9/11 commission chairman, Tom Kane, for being our first very special guest. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
And we will continue with How to Teach About 9/11, our first ever townie town hall, and much more. It's the Brian Lehrer Show at Montclair State University on WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio.